Oink.
Okay.
Okay, so we've been covering the seven-step practice by Geshe Chekhova. And we're going to continue that today. We're up to step four, which is called a summary of an entire lifetime's practice. And he's talking about five powers in this practice. Now, this part also introduces the practice of poa. Po is a verb meaning to move, you know, like you pack up your house, all your belongings, and move them to a different house or an apartment, kind of like that. And poa is the practice of transferring your consciousness to a different body. In our tradition, poa is a secret practice. Vajrayogini has a very beautiful poa practice in it. But Geshe Chekhova introduces to us in this section of the seven-step practice a non-secret way to do poa and a very, very effective way too. But we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves. So this part of the seven-step practice, which is step four, is about five powers, which is tokna. Say tokna.
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 Tokna. Yeah, good. Tokna.
Tokna.
Na means five. And tope means, well, you've had tope before. This tope is the same spelling, the same tope, as in topshi, the four forces that you use when you purify bad actions, like when you do your book. And it has the sense of strength or force or power to do something. One of the examples given in a Tibetan dictionary of what a tope is they use the word rammer or pile driver. I don't know if you know what a pile driver is. You've seen them when they're building freeways or bridges or even tall buildings. But they're these big, tall devices. And they get a long, like 50 or 80 or 100-foot piece of steel. And there's a thing on top that just hammers them into the ground. That's a pile driver. So that's kind of the idea of what tope means. And here it's power, you know, the strength to do something. And these five powers are things that you can do during your entire life. So the first one is called projecting power. And the Tibetan is penpa. Say penpa.
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 Penpa. And the whole thing is penpa kitope, which is projecting power. Pen is a word that is used when you shoot an arrow, and in the spelling anyway. Pen also means benefit in another spelling. But this pen, you pen an arrow in Tibetan. And this is a practice that you can do when you wake up in the morning. In fact, it is a practice that you do when you wake up in the morning. So you sort of become conscious. And before you sit up in bed, you do this practice. Keep your eyes closed. And you decide what you are going to do for the rest of the day. You're deciding something like, I will not waste this day. And what do you decide to do? You decide to spend the day trying to eliminate your habit of watching out for number one, which is yourself. Watching out for number one, you know, is what we've always done. We don't put others first. And what's the evidence of that? Well, we're getting older. You know, we're aging. Some of us have gray hair or bald spots, you know. There could be a loss of vitality. You get tired more easily. Maybe brittle bones, things like that. You get sick more often. And all these are the direct result of taking care of number one. Getting rid of that tendency requires a lot of dedicated effort. So this is what you do just after waking up in the morning. You say, I am going to get rid of this habit of watching out for number one. That's what I'm going to spend my day doing. So what you're doing here is recognizing exactly who your enemy is. You know, your enemy is this tendency to take care of yourself first and put others second. And what you're going to do then in getting rid of that is to put others first, that you cherish others more than you cherish yourself. So that's the projecting power. This idea of recognizing the enemy is a very powerful one. Where Tibetans use the word pen, you know, penpa, to shoot, you know, you are directing your mind into what you're going to do during the day. You've recognized the enemy. And you don't say, please go away, because it ain't going to happen that way. You have to be forceful about it. And you just have to draw the line, you know, in the dirt, that you are not going to think of number one during the day. At least you're going to try to not think of number one during the day all the time, that you're going to try to put others first. So that sets your motivation for what you're going to do during the day. And you do this every morning from now on when you wake up. The second power is getting used to cherishing others first. Say kompa.
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 Yeah. Now, kompa is a word that we use normally to mean meditation. The spelling's a little bit different here. It's pronounced kompa, and it is related to the word for meditation. But here it means getting used to something. And this practice is checking in with yourself throughout the day. And you do this whenever you change the position of your body, or Geshe-la called this the changing the station of your body. There are four stations that your body can assume. There's lying down, there's standing up, there's sitting down, and there's walking, those four things. So whenever you begin to do one of those, you check in with yourself. You get into this habit of checking in. And think about, have I been thinking about what other people want as opposed to what I want? So you do this throughout the day. If you're just stuck at your desk sitting, you know, about all you can do is when you, you know, get up and go to the bathroom, is take that opportunity to check in with yourself. Another thing you can do is do it when you do your book. But whenever, you know, you start to do something physically, check in with yourself. Have I been thinking about other people more than I've been thinking about myself? And then just adjust your motivation right there. Oh, I'm going to think about other people. What do other people want? Why am I doing this thing at my desk right now? This is to help others. In what way am I doing that? How am I helping them? So you keep checking in with yourself, you know. The idea is, am I actively doing what I promised to do when I woke up this morning? And then the third power, the third of the five powers, is called the force of white seeds. Say, carpo sabun.
Carpo
sabun.
Carpo sabun.
Carpo sabun.
Carpo sabun.
Now, we've had these words before. Maybe not in this combination. Carpo, anybody remember what that means? Well, it's white. And sabon we had in the karma class. It means seed, like the kind of seeds that you plant in the ground, but also a karmic seed. So this is white seeds, pure white seeds. In Buddhism, white refers to virtue or good karma. And so every time you get even a little bit irritated, you know, or anxious or fearful, you know, your inner channels get a little bit more constricted when this happens. And this is what eventually causes your death. So we have to make sure that when these things begin to happen, that we change them right away. And we do this by doing the opposite of what we would normally do. Doing the opposite, having the opposite reaction to things that normally irritate us or make us a little bit anxious or something like that, doing the opposite actually loosens the knots in our channels a little bit. So by doing this, this pure white, that's what pure white means in this case. It's doing the opposite, you know, not doing the things that cause our death, but doing the things that will prolong our life or change us into a Buddha. We begin to change the negative ways that we normally react to unpleasant things. And by doing that, changing them, doing the opposite, this becomes the pure white seeds. Then we do things. So that's one thing that we do. The next kind of thing that we do is to do things spontaneously that help other people, you know, like teaching or working in hospitals or nursing homes or hospices and other such things. You transform your work into helping others. You can do that. So these last things, you know, the things that we do spontaneously, meaning that they aren't reactions to unpleasant things. These last kind of practices is figuring out ways to generate powerful good karma. Now, many of these things you do in private, you know, like studying emptiness, for example, doing Tonglen practice, doing your book, and so forth. The things you wouldn't do in private would be like working at hospices or teaching or, you know, doing something actively to help other people. So this third power has two parts. The first one is changing the bad ways that we normally react to unpleasant things. And the second part is doing good things. I use the word spontaneously, but what that means is that you do good things that simply aren't changing the way you react to unpleasant things in your life. So that's the third force, the third power. The fourth power is called destruction, ripping out the heart. So say Sun Jinpa.
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 We've had this before, too. It's one of the four forces. But Sun Jin means to rip out the heart of something. You know, you see this in some horror movies. Somebody reaches in and rips out the heart of somebody. That's what this is. You have to be ruthless with your tendency to watch out for number one. So this practice involves that whenever you see yourself begin to become concerned with number one, as opposed to being concerned with others, you know, that you just stop it. You smash it right there. You don't let it develop. You just get rid of it. And you have to be forceful about that. If you're, you know, with other people, when you realize this, you just sort of stop what you're doing right there, you know, and just make sure it disappears. You can't spend a lot of time doing that. But you can get good at it, you know. When you catch yourself thinking about number one, then you just get rid of it. And the fifth one, say Munlam.
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 Yeah. Munlam means we're going to have more Tibetan classes. Well, it means prayer, right? And you do this when you lie down to sleep at night. You review how you went after your main enemy during the day, you know, and you rejoice in having done this, you know. You succeeded a little bit in getting rid of your tendency to watch out for number one instead of thinking about what other people want. So you think something like, as you're doing this, you know, today I caught myself watching out just for me three times. And you rejoice in that. And then you dedicate the good things that you've done toward getting rid of thinking about number one. You dedicate that generating bodhicitta for yourself, you know. And you dedicate that to the two forms of bodhicitta. You know, the conventional wish for becoming enlightened and even the vows you've taken to do that. And then also to the ultimate bodhicitta, which is seeing, having a direct perception of emptiness. So you make a prayer that you can achieve bodhicitta, both kinds, okay? And you dedicate the good things that you've done to that bodhicitta. So these are the five powers, you know, of this fourth step in the seven-step practice. Make it a kadampa practice, meaning that you do it as much as you can and you keep it private. You don't tell anybody else what you're doing or thinking during the day. This just becomes something that you're doing. And the lines in the text for this practice, they're on page, I think, 21 of your reading, down at the bottom. The brief essentials of the instruction are combined within five powers. So we've just gone over what the five powers are. Now, this business of watching out for number one, of doing things for yourself and not others, you begin to get more and more subtle like this. We see people, you know, good people like Gandhi or Mother Teresa or others, you know, who have done very good things and they've died, you know. Mother Teresa worked only for her patients in the hospitals. Everything she did was for them. So what caused her death then? Well, it was probably, we can think about this, we don't know, of course, but it was probably the fact that she was attached to the feeling she had when she was doing good things for others. So when she was doing these things, very subtly, she was doing them for herself. She was watching out for number one. Abhisamy Lamkara talks about this a little bit with regard to understanding emptiness. And you finally get this understanding intellectually of emptiness, you know, and you say, that's it. Meaning that that's the way it really is from its own side. And that, of course, is false. So these very subtle things, you know, the more we practice, the better we get, better and better and better. But there's still this tendency to either see self things as self-existent with regards to an understanding of emptiness, or to watch out for number one, like being attached to the good feeling you get for helping others. And this is, of course, related to the fourth perfection, you know, joyous effort. Now, joyous effort itself is not attachment. It's just getting off on doing good things. But we still have to watch this tendency to take care of number one first and others second. And you do that. I mean, you practice, you do these practices, and you get to that part. Now, the next two lines in this, in your reading, in the great way, these same five are the advices for sending your mind. Cherish the act. Now, great way here means Mahayana. So, Geshe Chekhawa here is teaching Powa in a very special and very powerful way. Most Powas are taught as things that you do at the moment of your death. And there's many, many different kinds of teaching on that. But in fact, when you are dying, both your body and your mental functions are breaking down. There are five standard hallucinations that we go through when we die, as the death process is going on. And controlling what your mind is doing is simply not going to work at this point. You're not going to really be able to do these practices. And then there are special practices you can do, and you have to be trained by a lama over a long period of time to do them. And these practices are secret, you know. That kind of poa practice is a different thing, meaning that you can do them successfully when you die. But they're secret. But Geshe Chekhawa here is telling us to practice poa now. He says, use the five powers and convert them into dying instructions. So he's telling us to deliver our mind into death. If, for example, you learn that you're going to die from cancer in a few months or weeks or whatever, you know, use these five powers this way. You know, send them into death. And here's how we do that. So the first power is projecting power. And you think, you know, I'm going to die. I'm about to die. I will go into death itself. I will go into the bardo. But I will not lose one thought, namely the thought to help other people. So you practice this daily so that you can use it automatically when death comes. It may come unexpectedly to you, like in an automobile crash or something. And maybe you've got a moment or two to keep that in mind. But you've got to practice doing it so it just sort of pops in there, you know, when the time comes. Or, you know, if you know you're going to die, for example, from cancer or something else, then you can just keep this thought in your mind, you know, I'm going to die, and when that happens, I'm not going to lose this one thought of helping other people. And I'm going to carry that thought with me into the bardo. And the second of the five powers is getting used to cherishing others first. So in the poa practice, you get so used to this idea, you know, that when you die, you're not thinking about yourself, but of others. And this becomes so ingrained in you, you know, that you cannot help but think of helping other people when death comes to you. It's sort of like you're not worried about yourself when you die. You're worried about helping other people. That's the thought in your mind. And then the third force is the force of pure white seeds. So here you mentally give away everything that you have. You don't want to die having attachment to anything that you've owned. And this includes also being attached to members of your family or friends and so forth. The white seed's power then is giving away everything that you have. It's extremely bad karma to have attachments to things when you die or to other people, you know. The projecting karma that is generated when you die then, if you have attachment, will likely take you into a lower realm, you know, or a bad human rebirth, something like that. So you want to die free, you know, you want to die clean, no attachments to anything, including the Dharma, by the way, including yourself. The self is disappearing and it will be gone when you die. So you need to remove the attachments to yourself. And then the fourth power is the destruction power, ripping out the heart of things. And what this means with regard to Poa is destroying negative imprints in your mind of bad things that you've done in your life. Normally, these would be things that you've never told anybody. So here you look at them and you understand that those things are gone. Whatever you've done, those things are gone in your life. The deathbed confession that occurs in Roman Catholic practice is really a good thing from a Buddhist point of view. It's very important that you actually believe that those bad deeds are finished for you. You know, if you've been doing your book, then what you do is verify to yourself that nothing bad remains at all. And if there are things you haven't applied the four powers to, do that right away. If you're a person who's taken tantric initiation, then at this point you do a tundric. And if you don't know what that is, that's okay. But this step is very important to tantric practitioners. It's important to die with a fresh empowerment, you know, which means a fresh set of vows. And finally, the fifth power is prayer. And here, as you die, you acknowledge that you are going to hurt a lot. When you die, there is what some texts call an exquisite pain, a very intense, sharp pain that goes throughout your entire body. And what you do here then is you do a very special tonglen. And this tonglen is sort of like this. You think, as I die, I pray that all of the pain in the world should come into me and die with me. I dedicate my death to the happiness of all other beings. And then, also, you try to lie on your right side. You know, this is the position that Lord Buddha assumed when he pretended to die. The part of the last line of this section says, cherish the act. That's what this refers to. It refers to this act by Lord Buddha when he appeared to pass on. So this is an instruction to try to get onto your right side. So as you're dying, even if you've been in some sort of accident, see if you can kind of turn over onto your right side. This is very beneficial. My first teacher, whom I only had for something like 5 months, right after I entered the Dharma, because he died. He was from Montreal. And he had he was really good at casting out demons. And there was a sizable Vietnamese community around where his temple was. And one day they brought in a young girl who was possessed or something like that. And he worked with her for something like half an hour. And she left fine, you know. And one of his attendants looked in and he looked like he'd been beat up. He was just really tired and exhausted. And that night, when one of his attendants was preparing for him to go to bed, there was this huge purple bruise on his chest. And she said, Gessler, what happened? And he said, the demon bit me. And in the morning when she went in to wake him, he had passed. And he was lying on his right side with a very peaceful look on his face. So this is kind of what we try to do. So that's the POA practice with regard to the five powers. And it's a very, very important thing. It's something that we practice now doing, you know. So when the time of death comes, these things are familiar to us, and we do them right away. And they're especially beneficial, you know, for times when, you know, death is approaching and we know it, but we've got some time to spend getting ready for this. So that's step four of the five steps. And now we're moving on to step five. Before we get there, though, we have an interesting quotation. It's from it's Geshe Tshekhoa's last words. Somebody was there with him and wrote down what he said in his last moments of life, and as part of his biography. But he said, and this is a quote, he says, "I was praying that I could pass on to the lowest hell for the sake of every living being. It's not working, and I can't go, you know. All I can see before me now is the paradise of enlightenment." So he was practicing his own advice. He was dedicating his life to the happiness of others and taking on all the pain in the world. And he wanted in his next life to be born in the lowest hell realm so he could help the beings down there. That's what he was praying for on his deathbed. And they said, no, all I see is tantric angels, you know. So that's a really, you know, nice story, I think. It's on your homework. The class notes have the quote I just gave you. So think of that. It's kind of a long one, but that's okay. You can write it down. And now we get to section five. And section five is about how do we know when we've developed the good heart? You know, how do we know when I can say, okay, I got it? That point is when we understand that all the Dharma that's ever been spoken boils down to this one thing. You know, what the Dharma means is fighting our tendency to take care of ourself and to ignore other people. And that's when that is what's foremost in our mind, then we've got the Lojong. It doesn't necessarily mean we succeeded at doing that, but that's what we're trying to do. That's what our life really is dedicated towards. Now, there are one of the things it says, let's see, in the reading. Let me find the reading. All Dharma comes down to a single point. We just went through that. There are two judges. Keep the main one. Now, there are only two people, you know, who witness the success of your Dharma practice. And maybe we should say two kinds of people. The first kind is everybody around us, you know. Generally speaking, we should be getting along better with the people around us. We should be getting along better and better with members of our family. And that will happen if we're practicing well. You know, keep the main judge. That means that you as a second person, you are the one, really the only one, who is able to judge what you're doing. As you're doing those five powers throughout the day and you lie down at night, reviewing what you've done with regard to those five, well, the first four powers, This is where you're judging yourself. You're taking stock of what you've done during the day, as well as rejoicing in that. So we then don't worry about what other people think of us, you know, and we don't try to impress other people with our practice. We're doing this in secret. What we're trying to do with regards to others is to figure out what they need to be happy, so we can give them that happiness some way ourselves. What do they need? If they're suffering, what do they need to not suffer anymore? That should be our concern, you know, what we're doing. We don't have to impress them. Making them impressed about how good practitioners we are doesn't help them a bit, except maybe to give them some faith that they could do the same thing. But if we're doing that, if we're trying to impress others, then we're not doing Lojong. Because what are we doing? We're thinking of number one. We want other people to like us or be impressed to us. And that's not what we want to do. So if this inner judge, you know, if this person number two, ourselves, if it is sensitive, you know, and satisfied with what we're doing, then we're doing okay. Nobody else knows what we're doing personally. Nobody else knows our practice, our private practice. They may see that we're changing somehow, but they don't know what we're doing. So they can't judge what we're doing. They won't say attaboy, you know, with regard to a particular practice that we're doing. They may say something like, wow, I really like how you've changed, if they notice at all, you know. And that's okay, too. So we have to know our own mind, you know. We have to know what our life is like, what it becomes, you know. We have to understand how our heart has changed, this thing inside, how we're now really concerned with everybody else, that we love everybody else, that we have compassion for everybody else. And we have to feel this inside of ourselves. So at this point, the commentary says that the main judge of whether something is the Dharma or not is whether or not it is helping, you know, to fix our mental afflictions, like jealousy and anger, competitiveness, any of those things. And the next line says, be joy alone in an unbroken stream. And what this is talking about is that, you know, things are going well, but don't get too happy. You know, if things are going bad, don't get too sad. So we have to try to maintain an even keel. The even keel should be joy, by the way. But we don't get overexcited about that. Mainly because we don't get attached to it. We don't think that we're doing such a good job and we're attached to that. And then when things aren't going so well, yeah, well, you know, it's going to change. I'm doing the right things right now, and my heart will eventually change. You keep this even keel. Karma doesn't ripen immediately. It takes a while to kick in. So as you begin these practices, you may not notice any difference. Or you may, if you're doing them powerfully, or if you've done them in the past and now those are beginning to kick in. And that's okay, too. But we have to be patient, you know. Yeah, things aren't going so good right now. I've been practicing and it hasn't changed much. Well, you're your own judge of that. You know, you're not seeing much progress as you're looking at it. But you know that it's going to get better. It has to get better. The only result from doing good things is a pleasant experience. Your own happiness. So you've got to keep that in mind. So just keep on planting the good seeds, you know. You're doing this for the future, and maintain your joy about doing that at the same time. And then the next line, it's there when you can keep it unthinking. When you're learning to do something, like you're learning to ride the pommel in gym or something like that, when you're beginning to do that and you get distracted, you're going to hit one part of the pommel with your leg or something like that. If you're learning to ride a horse and you get distracted, you'll probably fall off. And that's the nature of learning to do things. Until you become good at it, you won't be very good at it. But when you do become expert, you're not going to lose your balance, for example. Your body knows what to do on the pommel. Your body knows what to do on the horse, so that you don't fall off or don't hit your leg on the pommel. And with Lojong practice, it boils down to your reaction time. When you encounter some irritating thing, you know, person, what you want to do is extend the time between that thing happening and you're getting angry to the point where you don't get angry anymore, or the point where you recognize the anger more and more quickly and stop it as it's beginning to grow. You stop it immediately. And this only happens with consistent, extended, continual practice. If you were really smart, you would put yourself in a bunch of irritating people, for example, and just practice not getting angry at them when the time comes. This may be the case for you already. It probably isn't. But we have to maintain this practice constantly to keep working at it. With regard to people making you angry, you can get to the point where you sit there and somebody yells at you or does whatever it is, and you think, I wonder what happened. You know, something bad must have happened to this person. He's angry or she's angry. And just think about that, you know. So the ability to adjust your thoughts immediately is the key to this practice. It's learning to do the opposite reaction. And by doing that, we reverse the aging process in us, or at least slow it down quite a bit. Now, it's also important that you don't get attached to your plans, you know, because new conditions might arise which call for a different approach. I was watching a movie called 1776 last night. It's about the 3 weeks just before the signing of the Declaration of Independence in the I don't know what it was called, the Provisional Committee or something, that consisted of representatives from all 14 colonies here in America. And John Adams is the main one. And John was a kind of obnoxious person. The opening, 1776 is a musical, and the opening song in there is John's gotten up to protest something, and everybody's singing the song, "John, sit down, shut up." kind of like that. But toward the end, when the Declaration was written, there was a strangely worded section there, which basically meant that that the new United States was going to abolish slavery. And the Southern delegation brought up this point, and when it was made clear by the Northerner, John Adams, that that was going to remain, they walked out. And what became clear was that that clause about abolishing slavery, correct as it may have been, had to be eliminated from the Declaration of Independence. Otherwise, there would not be any Declaration of Independence. And John Adams just won't move from it. You know, and Benjamin Franklin rather forcefully reminds him. He said the issue here, the goal, is independence. You know, it isn't about slavery or anything else. It's independence. And if that's what you want, then you've got to change your plans, you know. So this is the idea, you know, and we encounter much less drastic examples of this or instances of this when we work. But this is kind of what going with the flow means, you know. When conditions change, we have to change along with them. And this may even mean that something you've decided to do in the morning with your practice maybe has to change during the day to adapt to conditions. And I'll let you figure that out yourself about what that might mean. So that's the fifth point, the fifth step in the seven steps. The sixth step is a pledge to keep on developing the good heart. So the first part has to do, it says keep the three laws, right? And the three laws, the first one is not acting in a way that contradicts what you've committed yourself to. And this means that we don't get excited about being a crazy yogi or something and ignore our other vows. We can't do that. And it's easy when we begin to do these things and find ourselves not cherishing ourselves so much, but cherishing others more, that we get really, really excited about that. And then we may break other vows that we have, and we can't do that. So we have to keep our minds working all the time. The second of the three laws is that we never place ourselves in a dangerous situation. Meaning that we can't do anything that would put our body or mind that would damage them. Okay, rock climbing, for example, goes away. Skydiving goes away. Bungee cable cord jumping, whatever that is, goes away. Why? Because we are now dedicating ourselves to the service of others. And if we're injured, then we can't do that. So the second law had to do with that. We've got to take care of our own body and mind. We've got to keep it working well, you know, so that we can help others. So anything that endangers your body, that endangers your health, that endangers your mind, is not Lojong practice. So you must not do it. To see emptiness directly, you must be fairly comfortable. You know, you have to be well fed. You have to be not fat, but well fed. You know, your body has to work. You've got to be at top form. You've got to be healthy mentally and physically to see emptiness directly. And then the third law is that we don't fall into the habit of discriminating between others. This is one of our bodhisattva vows, right? But it means in Lojong practice that we aren't selective about what we do with regard to other people. There aren't some people that we treat better than others or that we apply Lojong to and not others. Simply because we might like them more or something like that. You may decide, for example, that for a month that your Lojong practice is going to be dedicated toward your family, aimed at your family, or another month that might be aimed at the people around you, and so on. You may decide to spend a month working in a hospice where your Lojong practice is directed to the people there who are dying, something like that. And that's okay. But you don't pick and choose sort of at random or arbitrarily people you're going to practice your Lojong toward. You just don't do that. We cannot do that. If we decide, for example, that so-and-so isn't worthy of this, or I don't like him very much, so I'm not going to practice Lojong with him, what you're actually doing is taking care of yourself first, not this other person. And then there's a line that says, change your mind and stay the same. This has to do with the fact that that our minds must undergo major changes in terms of how we work the paths, you know, renunciation, bodhicitta, correct view. We need to look at people in particular ways. We need to act toward others just like a normal person would act, you know. Other people should have no idea what's going on inside of us, you know, that we're undergoing a major transformation. So, you know, we change our mind inside, and that change is going to be drastic for most of us anyway. And then we stay the same with regards to how other people see us. They don't know what's going on. They may notice some changes, but they don't know what's happening. We may seem more cheerful. We may seem more patient, more loving, something like that. But they really don't know what's going on. So that's the class for today. We've done, we need to do number 7. Step 7. So we got one more thing to do. And these are advices for developing the good heart. And that starts somewhere in here. And now do the most important thing. This is on page 25. Oh, act now. Do the most important thing. What's the most important thing? It's what we've been talking about, you know, to crush, to stamp out, to tear out the heart of this tendency to watch out for ourselves as opposed to other people. And then it says, figure out both and free yourself. So the first thing that we need to figure out is what has gotten us upset, if we get upset, in the past. And we should concentrate on that thing first. So we take stock of our biggest failings, you know, the things that most often trigger this idea to watch out for me and not others. And we begin to work on those first. The obvious things are easy to work on because you can get hold of them. And since our goal is to develop a good heart, we have the intention to do that, and we can get rid of these obvious bad things fairly quickly. So we figure out the conditions, you know, under which like getting upset happens. Or becoming miserly, you know, cheap. What triggers that in us? And then we take a good look analyzing why that kind of behavior is unacceptable. And spend some time doing that. You'll do that on your cushion. You know, why is this sort of thing unacceptable? Mental afflictions are, when we analyze them, they're undefensible. They don't really make sense at all. They cannot be defended as being good things to do. And that's why we do this, you know, this sort of analytical meditation about them. And they hurt us. You know, we know that. As you begin to practice more and more, you will begin to understand, you know, the workings of your inner body. And you may not know that it's inner body to begin with. You know, right now you just may feel horrible when you get mad at somebody, like even physically sick. But more and more you begin to understand, you know, what's going on inside. And then once you've got the afflictions and the conditions identified, then you work on stopping them when they begin to happen. Once you've got them identified, when they occur, you will more easily recognize them. You will recognize them much more quickly after they begin to occur. So they don't have time to develop and send out lots of bad karma. And then they will eventually be controlled. And that's great, you know. So while we're doing this, we continually look at our vows, especially our bodhisattva vows, you know, and be careful about that. We don't want even the smallest form of any mental affliction to come up in us. So we take a look at how we can avoid doing those things in the future. And one line down here, stop thinking all the time about how wonderful you are. This is one of the bodhisattva vows too, you know, about praising yourself and criticizing others. Now, the point of this isn't to generate low self-esteem. We cannot have low self-esteem when we're helping others. So anybody, you know, who's really doing a Lojong practice is a rather amazing person. You know, one in a million is probably too generous, you know, is one in maybe 10 million who's doing a really good Lojong practice. So when you finally get to the point, you know, where you do something and you help other living beings, you know, don't get too happy with yourself. So we've got one extreme about having low self-esteem. No, you can't have that happen. But then you can't be too happy with yourself either. And to do this, we think about these things. The other people that we're trying to help really do need us. You know, their mental afflictions are literally killing them, you know. We figured out that our mental afflictions kill us. And now we understand that people who need our help, their mental afflictions are killing them as well. And we have vows to help them. We've sworn to help them, right? So with regard to getting this kind of big head, we've sworn to help them. So what's the big deal about actually doing that? We're just doing what we promised to do. Yeah, good. We're going to get good results from that. But it's no big deal other than that. That's the counter thought to getting a big head about what we're doing. Getting a big head is actually self-cherishing. And then the last line in this paragraph says, don't expect any thanks. And this refers to four things. If you're doing a spiritual practice, you know, nobody's going to thank you for doing that. Remember, we're doing this in kind of a kadampa way. So, and that's good. No, but nobody's going to know what we're doing. So when you sit down in your chair, you know, to do these meditations, or when you're going around helping other people. Don't expect people to thank you. You know, after all, they really don't know what you're doing or why you're doing. What you're doing, aside from the thing, the specific thing you're doing to help somebody, is getting rid of your own self-cherishing mind. That's what you're doing by practicing the Lojong. So don't expect any thanks for that. Nobody's going to appreciate what you've done. The second part of don't expect any thanks has to do that you shouldn't expect help from anybody else. And that's the main thing. You know? When we actually get this great compassion, the personal responsibility, I will take everybody else to enlightenment by myself alone if necessary. So don't expect help from others. The third part of this is that we shouldn't expect people to say nice things to us. Not even your lama. Your lama's not going to know what you're doing. So don't expect the attaboy when you're doing these kinds of practices. And finally, the fourth thing is that we shouldn't wish for any fame or reputation in what we're doing. And these four things here are sort of like the four worldly dharmas that we talked about, or the eight worldly dharmas, which are four pairs of things like that. You know, what we do is that we just help others quietly and privately. That's the Lojong practice. Okay, so now we're done. If we have any questions, be happy to take them.